Fasten your seatbelts in, turn up your radio. We're going on a road trip. Is Earth a unique outpost of life in a vast and empty universe? How did planets come into being, and why are they in their current state? Are there advanced civilizations that we can detect, and what would be the societal impact if we do? Welcome to Route 51. I'm Shereen Seawert. Since the beginning of time, humanity has wondered whether we're alone in the universe. As NASA has explored our solar system and beyond, it has developed increasingly sophisticated tools to address this fundamental question. Within our solar system, NASA's missions have searched for signs of both ancient and current life, especially on Mars. Beyond our solar system, thousands of planets have been discovered that are orbiting stars, and efforts are continuing to search for intelligent life on Earth-like planets elsewhere. Joining me today is Dr. Margaret Maggie Turnbull, an Antigo High School graduate who went on to become an astronomer and astrophysicist. She's been deeply embedded in the search for Earth-like planets and organisms in other areas of our universe. Dr. Turnbull, welcome to Route 51.
Good morning. Thank you for that beautiful music introduction. I'm visualizing the USS Enterprise right now flying through all kinds of, like, colorful clouds in space.
Yes, it seemed kind of appropriate, right?
Yes, yes. Love it.
Callers, you can join as well. Join the conversation, 800-780-9742. Your questions are welcome. So, Maggie, I know that you have held a number of roles in the field of space exploration. You worked at SETI, the Search for Extraterrestrial Intelligence Institute. You were part of the Hubble Space Telescope team. You were a consultant for NASA's New Worlds Observer. It's quite the resume there. But born in Milwaukee, grew up in Antigo. What drew you to this field in the first place?
I think I was just born this way. I've always been interested in, I think, you know, my very earliest memory actually is I was probably only 5 or 6 years old. And I remember the place, my little like kindergarten place, having a set of little encyclopedias about just stuff like animals. And one of them was about planets. And I opened it up and there was this big picture of Saturn. And it was so amazing, like just so interesting with those rings. And yeah. I think I was probably hooked from that point forward. But, you know, I had a lot of encouragement. My dad is a naturalist, and he's always been fascinated with all questions about nature, including space and just big ideas. So I had that in the household encouragement.
Sure. Well, what exactly does an astrobiologist do? I mean, what is the role there?
Okay, so astrobiology is a pretty big field, and it really didn't quite exist as a field in any kind of established way until right around the time when I was in graduate school, NASA started to bring the NASA Astrobiology Institute together. And astrobiologists do everything. I mean, there's everything from microbiologists who study extremophiles, you know, microscopic organisms that live around hydrothermal vents at the bottom of the ocean. You get geologists who are studying the history of the Earth and all of the changes that the Earth has been through in its past, but still has supported life all through that those changes. And then you have planetary scientists who are looking for the possibility of life on Mars in water tables underground, maybe, or Jupiter's moon Europa in salty oceans under the ice. And then you have people like me, astronomers, who are studying the nearest star systems to the sun and looking for planets around those stars, including the possibility of habitable planets like ours that are at just the right distance from their star to be the right temperature. So you get this whole mix of people coming together, and each one of them has very detailed knowledge in their own area. But we have to try to understand each other as a community. So it becomes like this hive mind, sure, where we have this overall really big picture about how the relationships of everything in the universe to everything else make it possible for life to be here and possibly elsewhere.
Well, you worked for SETI, and I'd like to talk about that a little bit. Can you explain what the scientists at SETI do?
SETI is like a microcosm of the whole astrobiology field. There are so many different kinds of people that work for SETI. I originally was attracted to SETI specifically for the search for intelligent, for technological signals. We don't say intelligent. We say technological signals.
Okay.
So the idea is that a civilization, once it develops the kind of technology that we have to be able to communicate remotely, it has the capability of communicating in between the stars. And you could see that and actually start to know things about life elsewhere without having to go there. And that's what I was originally attracted to. But SETI scientists do a lot, all those kinds of things that I just described.
So have the scientists there found life or at least evidence of life on any other planets so far?
No, but we're such at the beginning of our search. I mean, this is like we're just starting to appreciate how widespread planetary systems are. I mean, we now finally understand and can show that almost every single star in the galaxy does have a planetary system. That's news. Like for,
right,
you know, for the last thousands of years of astronomers looking at the sky, that was completely up for debate. Even just a couple decades ago, it wasn't known. Mm-hmm. Like, and not only that, we're starting to realize that the nature of those planetary systems is such that there are literally billions of stars in the galaxy that do have an Earth-sized planet in their habitable zone. So it's just statistically we know that that is the case. So the potential for life elsewhere is starting to get clarified in our minds so that we can start doing searches that would actually find and then start to characterize planets for signs of life.
So that sounds like there's this evidence that points to the possibility of life really being out there. I've been reading a lot about the Kepler planets. First, if you can explain what they are, and then I'm really curious if these are places that we could theoretically move to, say if our own world could no longer support human life for some reason.
Well, let's hope that doesn't happen. But
for sure.
Yeah. So Kepler, NASA's Kepler mission was a space telescope that flew, I mean, it's still out there, flew and in space and observed one patch of sky for 4 years. And in that patch of sky, it was a patch of sky chosen because it's in the direction of the galactic center, so there's lots of stars in that field. And it monitored hundreds of thousands of stars for 4 years straight, just monitoring their brightness. And what they learned from that is there are planetary systems that are oriented edge-on from our perspective so that the planets will pass in front of their star and the star looks a little bit fainter for a few hours and then goes back to its normal brightness once the planet is not in front of it anymore. And that's what Kepler was looking for, was those transiting planets that pass in front of their star. And it found thousands of them, thousands, and including many Earth-sized planets around all of these stars. And if you just Google NASA Kepler, it will come up with so many cool graphics, like depicting,
yes,
you know, little cartoons of what all these different planetary systems, even animated little cartoons with the planets orbiting their stars and all different kinds of stars and different configurations of planets. And so interesting. But because that was just one patch of sky that all those stars are at different distances in that line of sight toward the center of the galaxy. And, you know, some of them are closer and most of them are are pretty dang far away. So, you know, we're not traveling there.
Right.
But, I mean, the reason for doing that experiment was to get a statistical sense of how common terrestrial planets might be. And that is what that mission accomplished for us. We now have a much better understanding of how common Earth-sized planets are. And the individual systems, some of them can be followed up with other kinds of observations.
I was going to ask about that. Like, what comes next?
Yeah, some of those systems can definitely, and they are being followed up with other kinds of observations in order to learn a little bit more about those planets and what they might be like. But for the most part, because those systems are a little further away, they're fainter, you know, there's limits to what we can really learn on an individual basis about each one of those targets. So the next step really is to start, now that we're sort of armed with this new understanding of how common the different kinds of planets are, the next step is to start really searching individual nearby stars for planets. And the goal is to be able to actually take pictures of planetary systems.
Okay.
We've done a very extensive, and by we, I mean my colleagues who are very much smarter than me. But
oh, come now.
We, we have monitored all the bright stars and nearby stars in the sky. I mean, you can see them with your naked eye. Many of them are much like the sun. We've monitored them for wobble back and forth that indicates the presence of giant planets like Jupiter and Saturn. The Earth doesn't make a very large wobble, so that it's so small. So we're not quite at the capability of actually seeing a wobble from an Earth-sized planet, although I think we're going to get there. But the goal is to be able to actually take pictures of those planetary systems and see light, starlight reflecting off of planets. And that light will carry information about the atmosphere of the planet. Does it have water? Are they habitable planets potentially? Do they have seasons? Are there oceans and continents like ours? All of that information is carried in the light, the signal coming from reflected starlight off of that planet. So we are really working on toward that goal of taking pictures.
What about the possibility for a planet in the same orbit as Earth on the opposite side of the sun? There's been some discussion about that. Is that possible that there's a planet in the orbit that we have not been able to see?
There are a couple of points around. These are called Lagrange points. They're around surrounding the Earth and ahead and behind the Earth and on the other side of the sun from the Earth that are theoretically stable for other objects to be in orbit around the sun at that location. But they aren't stable points. I mean, never say never, but it's unlikely that there it's actually just from the dynamics of the planets that we can see, there is no possibility of an Earth-sized thing that we would not know about that's on the other side of the sun.
Okay.
There's no way that that's possible.
All right.
Well, maybe little things, but not.
Okay,
no.
Something small, but not yeah. Earth size. Okay.
Yeah.
You're listening to Maggie Turnbull, our guest today on Route 51, as we discuss the ongoing search for intelligent life outside our planet and our galaxy. Your questions are welcome, too. Join the conversation by calling 800-780-9742. I'm Shereen Seward. This is Route 51 on Wisconsin Public Radio. We're back on Route 51. I'm Shereen Seward. Dr. Margaret Maggie Turnbull is our guest today. discussing the ongoing hunt for extraterrestrials and the most recent discoveries scientists are focusing on. We'd love to hear from you, too. The number to call is 800-780-9742. Maggie, I have to say that space dominated the headlines in 2019. A lot of things happened. There were stories ranging from the farthest object ever visited to the first photo of a black hole, which is extremely interesting to me. China landed on the far side of the moon. Is there one thing that you would say is the most significant discovery of the past year?
Oh, my goodness. Could you have, like, thrown this to me in advance? Oh. I could have showed up armed. Well, that is a wonderful question. All the things you just mentioned are such interesting developments. And I'm a little obsessed with the mission that I've been working on, which is a total roller coaster experience. So my attention has been pretty absorbed just in all of that. But gosh, I don't know. I guess my sense of what's happening is that we're finally getting to a point where all these different pieces of information are starting to come together in a way that will enable us in the near term to start actually knowing things about life on nearby planetary systems. But I love all the things that you just mentioned. That black hole imaging result was amazing last year. That was stunning. And I actually coincidentally happened to be in Washington, D.C. on the day that that was announced, having lunch with the president of the American Astronomical Society. And he had been up for all hours, like, preparing for that announcement. And, you know, we're sitting next to him when the announcement was made. And they had been secretly working on that for months leading up to the release to the press. Mm-hmm. And it was just sort of fascinating to see that whole thing behind the scenes.
Oh, I'll bet. I'll bet. We have a caller. It's Chet from Janesville. Thanks for joining us, Chet.
Hi, Dr. Trumbull. This
Hello.
Is Chet. I sat next to you, I want to say, about 4 years ago on a flight to Phoenix.
Oh, nice.
Yeah. And this year, we're not going to be able to go to Phoenix to backpack, as there's been some fires back in the Superstitions. So we're heading off to Death Valley this year in about 5 weeks.
Great.
So you had a question about some alien life. What did you want to know?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I'd like to. It's really an existential question. And is how are humans considering the discovery of Copernicus in the sun-centered universe or solar system, and the trial of Galileo? How will we today, are we more enlightened today and accept the discovery of aliens?
Oh, great question.
Great question. And it's so good to hear you, Chet, after meeting on a plane many years ago. It's coming back to me. So this is obviously we're standing on the shoulders of giants here, you know, not just in terms of the scientific work that has been done, but the collective understanding and what we're willing to even consider as a species. And we're very human centric, we're very earth centric. But this whole process of discovery over the last hundreds and hundreds of years has been one of opening up, just expanding our view of and experiencing really this tension between wanting to be special and unique, and really we are as far as we know, and yet like gradually realizing that we are not at the center of the universe, and the whole thing doesn't just revolve around us, and there could be other planetary systems, and there are actually other planetary systems out there, and some of them could host life. So I think what we're facing right now an age of development mentally and emotionally where we have to grow our minds large enough to simultaneously think of ourselves as incredibly unique and special, not duplicated anywhere else, and yet possibly one of billions of living worlds, even within our own galaxy. And unless we can embrace those two things at the same time, we're always going to feel, you know, kind of that discomfort with our, you know, what does it mean? You know, what's the meaning? What's the purpose? Do we have, is there anything special about us?
James from Stevens Point is on the line, and James has a question about spectral signatures. Welcome to the program, James.
Hi. Hi. I'm a biology student at the UW Stevens Point here. This is really interesting. And I was just wondering how they're able to measure some of, like, the elements on planets, if they're there, if there's, like, a silicon-based planet, or how they're able to do that, and then what kind of elements might be biosignatures for potential extraterrestrial life.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, great question. So what you're alluding to is the fact that our planet has a certain balance of elements, you know, silicon and carbon, for example, and that the ratios of these elements are incredibly important to the overall structure of our planet. If we had ended up with a lot more silicon on our planet or a lot more carbon on our planet, we could have a very different outcome in terms of things like plate tectonics and cycling of the atmosphere and maintaining a habitable planet over billions of years, as well as the bioavailability of the different essential minerals for life processes. And that is something that points to how complex planets are. I mean, I think planets are the most complicated thing in the entire universe, that terrestrial planets are, because there's so many different possibilities. What we can do right now is look at the nearby stars and see what they are made of. And if the stars have a ratio, like, say, a very high amount of silicon relative to carbon, or the other way around, or different ratio elements, we can sort of begin to kind of guess at what that might mean for terrestrial planets orbiting them. But what we actually need at the end of the day to test all that, all those predictions, is pictures of planetary system, sure, and actual light coming from the planets themselves, so we can analyze that and start to understand their atmospheres and surfaces. And that is the information we need to start getting at the question you're asking, is, you know, the elemental makeup of the star, does that predict what the planet is going to be like? And if so, what does that mean for the structure of the planet and its habitability?
Interesting. The number to call, if you have questions, please call 800-780-9742. I'd love to get those calls from listeners. I wanted to go back to some of the photos we were talking about. A month after that black hole photo was published, there was this supermassive black hole at our galaxy center that suddenly lit up. Does that suggest it might have swallowed something big? When you see a black hole light up, is that what's happening, that it's swallowing something? And what might it be swallowing?
Yeah, so black holes, you know, I mean, a black hole is an object that is so massive and compact that even light cannot escape the gravitational pull of that object. That's why it's black. So black holes don't, you know, it might be a little weird to think about a black hole lighting up, you know, and emitting light. The reason that there are strong emissions coming from black holes is because stuff is falling in. And in the process of falling in, it gets heated up to millions and millions of degrees. And that emits a lot of light just before it all disappears across the event horizon of a black hole, lost last forever to the universe. But that, and so when we have these, you know, brightening events, that is the belief of what is happening. You know, stuff is, large chunks of things are falling into these black holes. And now I've lost the thread of the, what were you asking again?
I was just asking what it might be, like what it might be swallowing. Yeah.
Yeah. So, yeah. So, I mean, it could be a star, another star or a bunch of stars or a bunch of gas and materials, whatever it was, it got thoroughly shredded before it fell in.
Whoa.
So, yeah, because things get stretched out and just absolutely shredded in that intense gravitational potential before it falls through the actual event horizon of a black hole.
Sure. I saw a story about an amateur astronomer who spotted the second object ever to enter our solar system from interstellar space. It was a comet. And as that comet was visiting from outside our solar system, scientists then released findings from Voyager 2 that found this mysterious extra layer outside our solar system. What does that suggest to you?
Well, I am not – so as a professional, we kind of – we speak a slightly different language from the language that you would read in articles like this. So I'm not exactly sure what a mysterious extra layer is referring to with our solar system. I have a feeling that what it's referring to is there's a bubble kind of around the sun. The pressure from the sun's radiation and the solar wind, it creates kind of a bubble around our planetary system where particles coming in from elsewhere in the galaxy can get deflected, or just the density of dust and gas in the interstellar medium between the stars is sort of pushed away from our planetary system. Like all these stars, you can imagine a little bubble around them as they're sort of going through the galaxy and making their way through the interstellar very diffuse gas and dust that's out there between the stars. So I have a feeling that that was referring to, maybe a caller can research it quickly and call in and tell us.
Yeah.
But I have a feeling that's just referring to that the bubble around the sun that sort of represents a separate environment, really, between our planetary system and the space in between the stars. Objects you mentioned, because you mentioned an asteroid flying through, and before that we had another one. This fascinates me. And the fact that we have now, you know, a couple of observations of this indicates to me that the exchange of material between planetary systems happens more often than we realize. So we might be in our safe little bubble sort of with regard to dust and gas, but these objects are still flying through. And to me, what this says is there is a real potential for panspermia. If life should arise in one planetary system and, say, a giant impact blows off some material from that habitable planet, those rocks could end up landing in another planetary system and seed life there.
It is fascinating, really. I mean, to think about, I guess what fascinates me most is what might be there that we don't know about. You know, these discoveries are so interesting. But what else is there? Again, the number to call, 800-780-9742. Can we talk a little bit about Mars?
Sure.
I know that there's been evidence for past water on Mars. What's the significance of that?
Right. So the history of the planets in the solar system is interesting and is something that planetary scientists have been working to piece together for a long time now. And Mars in particular is intriguing because it shows obvious signs of rivers and lakes and seas that once flowed on that planet. I mean, very clear, obvious signs of river channels. And the question is, and through all the analysis of what could have created all these flows, the the vast majority consensus is that Mars did once have water on flowing on its surface. And so how is this possible? Because A, it doesn't have water today, and B, it's a small, cold planet. I mean, by and large, the warmest places on Mars are still colder than the coldest places on Earth. Mm-hmm. So, but the idea is that in the past, when Mars was young, it was still outgassing a lot through volcanic activity. And so it had a greenhouse atmosphere that could have kept the planet warmer. And those temperatures were compatible with the existence of liquid water on the surface of that little planet. Mars is so small that it relatively quickly cooled down. Any volcanic outgassing pretty much ceased, and the atmosphere was eventually lost to space, and all the remaining water is now in the form of ice, with the exception of possible underground reservoirs. I mean, we do see signs in the edges of craters of occasional seepage. So when during the warm seasons, it's possible that there some of the ices, underground ices, or there are exposed layers of ice that are melting and seeping liquid water mm-hmm. still today.
Mm-hmm.
So that's the extent of my, I mean, I don't study Mars in detail, but mm-hmm. that's the overall picture.
Okay. I guess, you know, we have all of these Earth-like planets that have been discovered recently. And this might be an overly simplistic question, but do you think it's possible to send a space probe is that something that could be done to some of those newly discovered planets, see if they have life? Or is that just out of the question?
I think we should have launched a probe mission to Alpha Centauri and Proxima Sen decades ago, because it would be getting there right about now. And we could have close-up pictures of, even if all we accomplished was just a close-up high-resolution image of each of those stars. So Alpha Centauri is the nearest star to the sun. It's actually Alpha Centauri A and B. It's a pair of stars, and they are both relatively sun-like. One of them is very much like the sun, a little bit brighter. The other one is a little bit fainter, but they're in orbit around each other, and it is possible that each of them could have their own planetary system, including planets in each of their habitable zones. And there is a third star in the system, Proxima Centauri. It's a very faint red star in a really large orbit around the pair, which is known actually now to have a planet. So that system is 4 light years away. So if you were traveling at the speed of light, which is not going to happen anytime soon, it would still take you 4 years to get there. But if you were traveling at the speed of what is potentially possible, mm-hmm. you could get there in a couple decades.
Okay.
And send back like boots on the ground recon images mm-hmm. of those. I think that would be so interesting. I think we should have done it decades ago. I think we should do it now.
Well, right. We could theoretically then have some of the answers in our lifetime.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, we would learn a lot from that. Even if at the end of the day, we weren't able to, for whatever reason, hone in on planets around those stars once we got there. Because, you know, I mean, these are very small targets that are very far away that we're talking about, and we're not even sure if they exist. You know, the planets around these stars. But it would be, if nothing else, it would just be so cool to have really high resolution pictures of the stars and their surfaces and kind of compare and contrast with our own sun.
Yes, no kidding. Dr. Maggie Turnbull, our guest today on Route 51, as we continue our discussion on the search for extraterrestrial life. What would you like to know? Your questions are welcome. Join the conversation by giving us a call, 800-780-9742. I'm Shereen Seewert. This is Route 51 on Wisconsin Public Radio. We're back on Route 51. I'm Shereen Seward. Astrophysicist Maggie Turnbull is our guest today, discussing the most recent discoveries and ongoing efforts to answer the age-old question, are we alone in the universe, or does intelligent life exist outside the Earth? We'd like to hear from you, too. The number to call is 800-780-9742. There have been some pretty significant advances in telescope technology in recent years. I've been reading a lot about that, Maggie. I know we're seeing more, we're understanding more than ever before. So I guess I've got to ask, is 2020 the year that scientists will officially discover intelligent life on another planet?
I don't know about that.
We can hope. We can hope.
Right. Absolutely. Absolutely. If I could have a wish for us, that would be on the list of things. But the telescope technology is advancing rapidly. there are a lot of different conversations that could come out of that question or that topic, including, you know, some of the big telescopes that we're building on the ground and the choice of locations and how that impacts the people who live there, and including the technology that's being developed for space missions and the capability that we will start seeing coming online in the next 5 years or so, 5 to 10 years, and what that will lead to for us. But astronomers are very inventive people, and we've been striving to have a better view of the cosmos for a very long time. So and the technology is going leaps and bounds beyond, you know, what it was even a decade ago.
I know we talked earlier about SETI and their ongoing efforts to listen for those signals. Can you explain a little bit how those signals are measured?
Sure. So in the radio, so radio waves, like what we're using right now in order to transmit my voice to you and our voices to the rest of the world, that is light. I mean, those are photons, and that electromagnetic radiation can travel through space between the stars. And space is, you know, it's very open and spacious and by and large, you know, empty. But there are certain wavelengths of light that travel through it better than other wavelengths, because it's not completely empty. It's full of gas and dust and stuff that will block and absorb these transmissions. But at certain wavelengths in the radio spectrum, light will penetrate right through that and be able to, at very low cost to us, allow us to transmit information between the stars. So SETI is honing in on those any signal like that would be like a very narrow band transmission, because nature, the natural world, does not create, for the most part, does not create narrow band signals like that. And there would be other features of a signal like that if it were coming from a planetary surface. You would see some redshift from the rotation of the planet relative to our perspective. That would indicate that it's not just a regular astrophysical source emitting masers or something. So you can design a computer algorithm that automatically notifies you when a signal like this comes into view if you're observing with a big radio dish like Arecibo in Puerto Rico. Mm-hmm. And I went to Arecibo a couple of times with the SETI team as the stellar biologist. So we had this target list that I made for them that ruled out a lot of stars that would be bad for life as we know it, because it would just be very inhospitable conditions. Mm-hmm. And as a new star would come into view and the telescope would start observing it and we'd be monitoring, the team would ask, okay, so what's this star? And then I would give them my take on the potential for planets and life around that star and which one we were looking at. So it was cool to do that. But it's actually very tricky with SETI to find these signals for follow-up, because we as a civilization are so noisy ourselves. We emit all of the exact same kinds of signals we'd be looking for. So with your big radio telescope is going to detect all of that.
Sure.
Like when a plane goes by, when a satellite goes by, when somebody uses their cell phone, when they turn on a microwave, like all of that radiation has to be ruled out.
Mm-hmm.
And so what you end up with is SETI observers have to work in teams where they will be observing from more than one place at once. So any signal that is seen by both observatories, say in Puerto Rico and in the UK, they will be able to rule out, you know, anything local.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
And just agree on the things they're seeing that are distant. But sometimes even that is tricky because they're very high-flying satellites or even NASA missions that, like, for whatever reason, didn't get into the database of things to watch out for and rule out. And they have been tricked in mm-hmm. the past into monitoring signals that it's like, what is that?
Mm-hmm.
And it turns out it's always, in every single case so far, it has turned out to be ourselves.
Okay. All right.
Radio interference.
We have a caller. Randy is on the line from Stevens Point with a question about stars. Hi, Randy.
Hi.
Thanks for calling. What's your question?
Well, I've been told our sun is relatively a smaller star than what's out there. And then I've been told, is it possible that there's more stars than granules of sand on our Earth?
Hmm. Good question.
Yeah. Great questions. So the sun... by and large, I would not describe it as a small star or as a big star. There are plenty of stars out there that are much larger than our sun, and plenty of stars out there that are much smaller than our sun. In fact, if you look at the population of stars in our galaxy, our galaxy is littered with tiny little stars. They call them red dwarfs, M stars in astronomy speak. And that is like 85% of the stars are these little, faint little red guys. They're, even though they're so numerous, and in fact, the closest star to us, Proxima Sun with the planet, is an M star, a red dwarf. You will not be able to see that with your naked eye. That's how faint they are. Even the very closest ones, you cannot see. So the sun is bigger and brighter than all those stars, but it's smaller and fainter than the most luminous stars in the galaxy that actually emit most of the light that make galaxies shine. So really, I would pitch the sun as very nicely middle way when it comes
okay.
to stars.
All right.
And then the other question was about just the numbers of stars
right.
compared to grains of sand on the Earth. I don't know how many grains of sand there are on the Earth, but it probably depends on how you count grains of sand. But I will say that there are about 300 billion stars in our galaxy, and there are as many galaxies in the universe, in the visible universe, as there are stars in our own galaxy. So 300 billion times another 300 billion. That's the number of stars that are out there. And if I could throw you one little factoid that I recently realized that blew me away, is that all of those stars is still less than the number of living organisms on planet Earth.
Oh, that is a bizarre feeling.
Isn't that profound?
Yeah, it is. I mean, when you think about that.
Like, I actually find that to be very moving to think about.
Yeah.
That there are more living organisms on little planet Earth than there are stars in the entire universe.
It's really amazing when you think about what's out there and the enormity of it. It's really hard to wrap our brains around it, I think.
Yeah, and how special we are and how unique we are, even in the midst of this vastness, this incomprehensible vastness.
Absolutely.
We are still a shining example of just a tiny, precious, unique little gem.
Again, the number to call, 800-780-9742. We were talking about those messages that SETI is searching for and listening for. if we ever got one that we could absolutely say, yep, this is not coming from Earth, this is not coming from us, how could you ever realistically send one back? I mean, given how far away the signals must be.
Oh, yeah, that's a whole other question. Like, could this ever be a two-way conversation?
Right. Could we have a chat?
I mean, this, it could be a two-way conversation between subsequent generations of you know, humanity. Mm-hmm. But in terms of, like, a live, you know, you say hello, we say hello back, and then you tell us something, and we tell you something, and ask questions, and get answers in reasonable time frames. I mean, we would have to figure out something else. We can't. The speed of light is excruciatingly slow compared to the size, you know, the separation between stars and the span of one human lifetime. Mm-hmm. So in order to have any kind of real conversation, somebody has to just come here, or we have to go there, or we have to figure out some other kind of, like, subspace communication channel that just bypasses most of space as we know it in order for the signal to get here.
We talked a lot about SETI, but I know you were part of the Hubble telescope team as well. What was your role there? What was that like?
Yeah, so I worked briefly at the Space Telescope Science Institute, and that is where we run the Hubble Space Telescope from. And I had a functional responsibility there to actually help write the script for the astronauts who were going to execute the final servicing mission for installing new instruments on the Hubble Space Telescope. So the last people to touch Hubble were engaged in that effort at the time that I was at Space Telescope. And so my role on that team of scientists who were supporting the astronauts to do this was actually to write a very detailed script of what needed to be done in order to correctly install and verify one of the instruments that they were upgrading.
Okay.
That was fascinating, actually, just to see how the astronauts work with mission control and train and prepare for a servicing mission like that. I mean, they have to have practice runs. They have to do very detailed, you know, everybody comes together, scientists, astronaut, everybody, and they pretend that they are in space actually carrying out the mission, and they follow this very extensive script for every single movement that they have to make. And then NASA will throw in contingencies and say, oh, you dropped your wrench, now what are you? And the astronauts have to scramble and prepare to handle these situations that could come up unexpectedly and still successfully execute their mission. Mm-hmm. And just kind of seeing all of that and everything that goes into play gives you a real appreciation for how many people have to work in concert with each other in order to pull off even just an upgrade to an existing facility, which most of us probably don't even think about. It's like one news article. Oh, Hubble has some new instruments. Okay, cool. And meanwhile, there was a decade of planning and effort and thousands of human life hours that went into making that possible.
You also consulted for NASA's New Worlds Observer. Can you tell us a little bit about that? That looked like a really fascinating project as well.
Yeah, I have to say that the New Worlds Observer concept for imaging, taking pictures of Earth-like planets around nearby sun-like stars, it was a total game changer for me professionally. It really, my professional life could be divided up into before New Worlds Observer and after New Worlds Observer.
Okay.
And when I left Space Telescope, because I realized that I really wanted to just be freelance and I wanted to run my own science program without a lot of institutional responsibilities, as interesting as it was, you know, to work on that, it took up a lot of my time, and I really wanted to have my own research portfolio where I called all the shots. But I had no idea how I was going to support myself. Mm-hmm. So in the move back to Wisconsin, I was really thinking about this, and the phone rang, and it was a professor, Webb Cash, at Colorado Boulder, asking me if I would lead the science team for this thing, this concept called the New Worlds Observer. And I was like, wow, this is, I had heard about this. It's a telescope that would fly in space and it would have a star shade that flies millions of miles in front of it. Mm-hmm. And the two would align so that the star shade blocks out the light of a star and you can see the planets around it. And you can get the pictures that I'm talking about that we need. And I think this is like a brilliant concept. And it was new. And I was like, this is great because A, I really want to work on that. And B, I need a job. So, that opportunity, that synchronicity between, you know, my leaving Space Telescope, really wanting to apply myself to my own science portfolio, and yet like wondering, okay, how am I actually going to fund? How am
sure.
I going to pay my bills?
Sure.
And that phone call from Boulder really like just all came together and kind of launched a whole new chapter in my professional life. So ever since then, I've been involved in New Worlds Observer-like concepts where we're talking about a space telescope plus a star shade that would enable you to take pictures of Earth-like planets around nearby stars.
Okay.
And now NASA is really investing heavily in that concept. So I'm hopeful that we will see that that become reality within the next 10 years.
Well, it is fascinating. I want to let listeners know. We'll have links to SETI, Hubble, NASA, and more at our website, wpr.org/Route 51. That is all we have time for today for a fascinating discussion on Route 51. I'm Shereen Seward. I'd like to thank our guest, Dr. Maggie Turnbull, for a great show. Our executive producer is Rick Ryer, who is also our on-air producer today. Special music today from Jerry Goldsmith, John Williams, Alexander Courage, and The Police. Thanks to John Altenberg for the Route 51 theme. You can hear the archive of today's program at wpr.org/Route 51. Next week, tune in for special election coverage with a debate between the two Democratic candidates in the race for the United States 7th Congressional District, the first of two debates leading into the primary election. Until then, we're heading out of town.